good, beautiful Juno afternoon to you. I'm Andy Klein, your host for this Friday of a Juno afternoon, and today we've got a great show. We're going to be learning about the screening of a new video, The Wisdom of Grandmothers, with producer Susan Stark Christensen and Patricia Richards. Becky James will be here from Above and Beyond Alaska. She's going to be talking about some special fundraising kayak trips. Also be talking, be great pleasure to be talking to Curtis Salgado about his Juno Jazz and Classics dance concert tonight. Blues legend Curtis Salgado here in town. And fish news legend Lainey Welch. We'll be talking to her about her role in this weekend's Juno Maritime Festival. That's all happening coming up right after National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Navajo Nation plans to build a Golden Eagle aviary. It will expand a current program allowing tribal members to legally obtain feathers of the federally protected birds for ceremonial purposes. As Arizona Public Radio's Ryan Heinches reports, outgoing Navajo Nation President Ben Shelley is expected to sign legislation to fund construction.
The legislation approves nearly $500,000 for the new 4,000-square-foot facility to be built at the Navajo Nation Zoo. The aviary will accommodate more than 20 golden eagles. David McKessick is the coordinator of the zoo.
We've, for the most part, barely scratched the surface of what we're capable of doing. We hope that this will increase our ability to serve the Navajo people.
In 2012, the Navajo Nation received federal permits to distribute naturally shed eagle feathers to its members. To date, more than 500 feathers from just four birds have been distributed to about 250 people. McKessick hopes the new program will reduce the black market trade of eagle feathers and also encourage conservation and education.
The aviary in itself will allow for us to use it as a teaching tool. We will be able to save the lives of, you know, up to 20 or more eagles that are injured and cannot be put back into the wild.
The tribal program has historically been much more timely in its distribution of ceremonial feathers than a similar federal program, several weeks versus several years, according to tribal officials. They anticipate the Navajo Nation Zoo's new aviary will be finished by the fall. For National Native News, I'm Ryan Heinches in Flagstaff.
The Lakota Emergence Exhibit celebrates the living history and art of Lakota people. As Charles Michael Ray tells us, the display in Rapid City, South Dakota, is the interpretation of the Lakota creation story by 16 artists.
Dr. Craig Howe is an historian and a curator of the exhibit. Howe says each artist was given a passage from a Lakota creation story and shown a set of artifacts from the Sioux Indian Museum. The artists then use the story and artifacts of the past to inform their new works.
To just do an exhibit about Lakota origin narrative that's set long, long ago, that's not that relevant to today if we just leave it like that. But when we bring in contemporary artists to interpret that, then they start to think about it and relate it to today.
For Howe, the exhibit also aims to inform viewers on a place-based history of the Black Hills.
And by learning about this narrative, we're going to learn more about where we live. We, all of us, where we live. Right here in the Black Hills, there's just a landscape that has this long, long history.
Howe says the 16 contemporary artists selected to take part in the four-day event bring a diversity of work, from oil painting to buffalo spoons to a beaded and decorated orange prison jumpsuit. For National Native News, I'm Charles Michael Ray in Rapid City, South Dakota.
Five names were added to a monument honoring those who died in the line of duty serving Native communities. A ceremony was held Thursday at the Bureau of Indian Affairs Indian Police Academy in Artesia, New Mexico. Law enforcement officers from Alaska, Arizona, and Michigan were recognized. Officials talked about the lives lost and the importance of public safety in Indian country. The ceremony ended with the reading of names and a traditional blessing. The Indian Country Law Enforcement Officers Memorial was dedicated in the 1990s. It holds the names of more than 100 officers who served at the tribal, state, local, or federal level. President Obama appointed Princess Johnson to the Board of Trustees of the Institute of American Indian Arts, a congressionally chartered college. Johnson is Alaska Native. She's an advocate for environmental and social justice issues for Alaska Native people and has served in various leadership roles, including the former executive director of the Gwich'in Steering Committee. She's also known for her work on stage and in the film industry. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. And by the law firm of Sanosky, Chambers, Saxe, Miller & Munson, advocating Native American interests throughout the United States, with offices in New Mexico, California, Alaska, and Washington, D.C. The Convention and Tourism Department of the Albuquerque Hispano Chamber of Commerce provides convention and event planning services for Native American organizations. Information at ahcnm.org. Native Voice One. The Native American Radio Service.
Some of the music there of Bria Schoenberg, who's going to be playing tonight at the Jack as part of the Juneau Jazz and Classics Festival. Such a great week here in Juneau when the festival's going on. Great couple of weeks. And next in the studio with me right now is Susan Stark Christensen and Patricia Richards, who've been part of a very interesting and long project that is culminating in a premiere that's happening this weekend, and it's all called The Wisdom of Our Grandmothers. Welcome to the studio. Thanks so much for coming in to both of you. And Susan, we'll start with you. Tell me about the beginnings of this project, what sparked it, and the sort of the journey it led you on.
Well, first of all, I want to thank you so much for having us on this beautiful Juneau afternoon.
Thanks
with
for coming indoors.
The sun shining. Yeah. It's so wonderful here today. Well, and what sparked the project, the film is called The Wisdom of the Grandmothers, and I actually left Juneau in October. It'll be 8 years this October. I would reached my own middle life and had been working, you know, for government, and a lot of people here know me from my media days and did a lot of different things. But I was looking at reaching my middle of my life and wondering, you know, am I really happy? Am I really doing what is my soul's destiny? And I had had the privilege of many years of working with a Tlingit elder by the name of Jim Walton. Many people know him. And Jim used to always talk about a teaching or a prophecy that is in many, many indigenous tribes. And it says, there won't be peace on earth until the voices of the grandmothers are heard. And I thought about that for many years, and I wanted to know, what is it about the grandmothers that is important in the world? So I was kind of, you know, at that place in my life where I was looking at making some changes, and I wanted to honor Jim, and I was interested in that teaching. So I set out with two women from Siberia, and we decided we didn't even know how to turn on a camera when we started. I was used to bossing people around, not doing it myself.
Much easier.
I had to make amends for that. So we set out with a camera, and we just met grandmothers along the journey. And I went from the north to the south. There's another teaching that many tribes have around the world, and it's that the longest journey is the journey from the head to the heart. And in many cultures, that's called the Good Red Road. And it's also referenced as the journey of the human being. So we set out in the north, and I had been to Siberia many times, to the Saha Republic, and Jim Walton had been there. And said, let's start out at the farthest north point people live in the Saha Republic and head south.
Wow.
And so I interviewed grandmothers that I met along that journey.
Wow, that's such a fascinating thing. We'll talk more about, not that it was not just, to me, when you first spoke of it, I thought, well, that's an intellectual journey. That's going to be an interesting thing. You're going to learn a lot. But it sounds like it also became, even more than an emotional journey, a very spiritual journey for you as well.
It was a spiritual journey, and I think it is a spiritual journey. And I think a lot of what's missing in the world today, at least what I found, is that when you talk to women, especially that are at the end of life and they're, you know, seeing life, more of life behind them than ahead of them, and you ask them questions about what matters to them, what's important, what I learned was that at the end of life, what matters to people is love it's relationships. It isn't any of the material things that so many of us spend so much of our life chasing. And I think I had spent a lot of my life looking at politics and different things, and I was empty inside in many ways. And so I was also searching for, well, what's missing out of my own life? And I think I learned that from listening to the wisdom that these wonderful mm-hmm. grandmothers that I met along the way had to share.
And Patricia, you were one of those people that Susan met along the way. Tell me a little bit about how you first heard about this project, knew about the project, and then you ended up becoming very involved in it.
Well, I didn't know about the project when I first met Susan. I met Susan in Ojai, and we met at a spiritual event, and I happened to be leading a group of people at that time to Peru, and she was looking for someone to take her to Peru. So that's how Susan and I connected. And that was in 2011. So I've watched this amazing project unfold at its own pace.
Yes, it was a project that kind of dictated its own speed in some ways.
Well, sure.
Yeah.
Having shared so much with Susan, I know there, I was able to experience some of her frustration, some of her disappointment, some of her, even to the point where she was questioning whether she should continue with the project. And at that time, especially from journeying at the level that I had been journeying at, I said, I think it's important just to trust and surrender, and it has its own rhythm, and it will unfold when it's time to unfold.
So you went to Peru as well. Now, did you, now, and there was more to that journey as well, right? There's more travel involved.
Yes, that. The journeys that I lead, I lead sacred journeys, and they're really not vacations. They're people that come on those journeys are really committed to deepen spiritually. So that trip, I believe, was about 12 days, and every day we were in ceremony with different shamans, and one of them is in the film. At that time, she was 80 years old. And just an amazing elder. And Susan has a
Quechua elder that we met on that trip that was a very traditional Quechua elder that, I had an opportunity to interview her on the top of a mountain in Peru, somewhere near Machu Picchu. It was quite amazing. And I think what, with Patricia, as far as this, meeting the grandmothers, one of the things that I wanted to do was to make sure that the people I interviewed were people I actually met along the journey, not someone that I knew, not someone famous, not somebody. They're just ordinary women, quote unquote, ordinary women. And I think what I found was that so many of these women were honestly extraordinary. And what I think is missing in the world, and one of the things that we found, is that often as women age and get to be middle age, they begin to feel as if their life is over. They've raised their children. They don't see themselves in the media. They're not valued in many cultures and in many societies, including our own. And so much of that respect for older women is really lost. And a lot of the times when you see women in the media, they're the jokes. They're the, the funny old lady. And so I found that as I was beginning to ask women to share the stories of their life and tell me what mattered to them, what they learned along their life journey, they were so open and so willing and wanting to share that wisdom that they've learned in their life with younger women and to be able to lead them and guide them. Patricia's been someone that's, helped me and guided me, and I've learned so much from all of the women.
Are there a few that in particular stand out to you as being particularly either enlightening or a surprise, that they had such a surprise to their story, or such a surprise to the type of wisdom or the type of advice that they would give?
Well, I think one of the surprising things for me was how common and how uniform from Siberia to Patagonia the lessons learned were for these women. And I'd like to touch on them briefly and then ask Patricia to go in a little deeper on some of them. But Women talked about, again, as I said, the importance of love, the importance of relationships, the importance of faith. They were from everything from Baha'is to traditional people to Christians and Jews. It didn't matter what religion. People talked about having some sort of a higher power to help them along in life's difficulties. They talked about the importance of community. How important it is when you have a problem to get together with other people and to be able to speak about that and talk about that. They talked about that as you kind of reach the end of life and you look back, you don't really care so much about all those material things that you thought were so important. They don't matter to you anymore. And so there was uniformity. And the last thing I think that really came out is a real sense of commitment, a deep commitment to caring for Mother Earth and leaving behind a legacy of peace and an Earth that's in a good place for their children and grandchildren.
Well, that's an interesting thing that I don't know if I would have anticipated, but it makes total sense. But it's interesting to think about it that way. Is there something there that... to what Susan was just saying, that kind of touches a memory to you, or something that you think is a common thread that many grandmothers have?
Well, the common thread that I was hearing was the importance of the connection with the heart, moving from the head to the heart. And because that's much of the work that I teach, is getting people to really open to their heart center and open to a spiritual path of whatever's calling them, honoring all paths and knowing that I don't have the answer, but that if they learn how to open their heart center, they will operate from a place of compassion and unconditional love, and also a place of selfless service. I know for me, speaking for myself, I want to leave the planet in a better place than when I arrived. And that has to do with any place I go. Like even coming here, I feel so blessed to be in beautiful Juneau. And today I was at the dock having lunch, and I just saw, like, people just left their trash, some plastic ready to go into the ocean. And so I just spent like a minute bending down, picking. It can be very small things, but I feel we're here to be love, give love, and to come together as one, and to share what we have. You know, I alluded to that in the film, that there's enough on the planet for everybody to have something, and that we should be sharing.
Beautiful message, and I want to thank you both for coming in and just remind people that the reason we're talking about this here in the studio right now is because Mother's Day is kind of the most appropriate day this could possibly premiere on television, right? And that's what's happening on 360 North. It's happening at 7 p.m., 360 North, and then also national affiliates throughout the country as well as are also picking this up.
Yeah, we're not sure on the dates on the national affiliates yet. We're in the process of getting it ready for that, hopefully. But I'm so blessed to be able to share it with people in Alaska First. This has been my home and where I've learned so much over the years, and it's just a blessing to be able to also share it with 360 North, which is something I really believe in, and so I really appreciate the opportunity, and I hope people will tune in with their mothers and their grandmothers after dinner on Mother's Day and turn on 360 North and watch it, and I also hope that people will turn around and ask their own grandmothers to share their stories and learn what it is that their grandmothers want to share and what's important to them, so that we can learn from the wisdom that, you know, the previous generations have to pass down.
What a wonderful way.
Beautiful.
Well, yeah, what a wonderful thing that would be if that happened just a few times after watching this. That's the wisdom of grandmothers. It's the producer is Susan Stark Christensen. Thanks so much for coming in. And Patricia Richards appears in it and also was instrumental in helping many of the interviews happen, it sounds like. So thanks so much to both of you for coming in. It's happening, that's on Mother's Day, which of course everyone knows is Sunday. I know you know that Sunday is Mother's Day, everyone. It's happening on 360 North, so Watch It Then. Susan and Patricia, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you so much.
On the air. You've heard him online. Now you can have him whenever and wherever you want him.
I'm Matt Miller with a look at today's headlines.
Yes, it's the greatest hits of Matt Miller.
Today's forecast promises rain in the capital city.
The greatest hits of Matt Miller, not available in any store.
The airport reports that all planes are running on schedule.
The greatest hits of Matt Miller. Tune in to Morning Edition, weekday mornings on KTOO News.
Support comes from Alaska Canopy, now accepting applications for the 2015 summer season. More information at alaskacanopy.com.
And welcome back to Juno Afternoon. Andy Klein, your host here, and with me now, Becky James has joined me. Becky, thanks so much for coming in.
Hey, thanks, Andy.
Becky's
great to see you.
With Above and Beyond Alaska, and you've got a really cool thing you're doing, which is just... not only doing your amazing kayak expeditions that you do, but taking a part of the proceeds from that and helping out a nonprofit. So tell me a little bit about what's going on at Above and Beyond.
Yeah. So we do, our daily guided trips that we offer and overnights for visitors coming into town. But specifically, we're offering this year some local expeditions. And, you know, it's just a great way to get people from our community out to all the different wilderness areas that we do take clients out. And specifically also just to get out and kind of get a sense of, being able to kayak and try different modes of activities. And so we have three different locations we're offering local trips this year. One is Admiralty Island. So we have a Pat Creek trip coming up where you actually get a paddle one way from Juneau all the way to Pat Creek, and you end up at Pat Creek, and then you fly out by float plane.
That's
so it's
awesome.
Like a one-way route, which is really cool.
Yeah.
And so for all these trips that we're doing, we're actually we're doing them at cost because we just want to kind of generate interest and get people excited about all the different areas. But we also, it's great for our guides because it diversifies their schedule. And then we're also choosing a local nonprofit that's pertinent to the trip that we're going to be donating 5% of the proceeds to. So we have our Admiralty trip that's in May. That's the Juneau to Pat Creek, and those proceeds go to Friends of Admiralty. And then we have a, we operate out of the Channel Islands, which is out kind of by Lincoln Island and kind of Shelter Island area. But specifically, we'll be doing a camping trip at Lincoln, and those proceeds will be to Discovery Southeast. And those trips, let's see, that trip date is in June. And all these dates are actually posted on our website, or just contact our office for more information. And then the third trip is going to be camping up at Lemon Glacier, and those proceeds will be to the Juneau Ice Field Research Program, the JRPS.
So I've done all of these things, by the way. I haven't done the kayaking part necessarily, but but I can't recommend highly enough Pack Creek. Number one, if you've never been to Pack Creek, boy, it's such an experience to go watch bears just hanging out and doing stuff.
And then also being able to do a one-way route, because a lot of people, you know, we rent kayaks from our kayak shop. They'll kind of paddle out to Oliver Inlet, down Seymour Canal to Pack Creek and back. But this gives locals an opportunity to do a one-way. So you just paddle straight there, leave the boats at Windfall Island, picked up by plane and come back. And
it's really cool, over
Memorial Day weekend. So it's a 3 days. You're not taking too much time in your schedule. So it's really a great opportunity to be able to do a different route for even avid kayakers. And then the Channel Islands is great. I mean, that's just a hub for wildlife viewing. You know, the whales are going off right now, especially with the hooligan run. So there's lots of opportunity to see wildlife. And that trip is going in June, though. And just being able to, you know, paddle from island to island and just being out there for a couple of days. And that's just a one-night trip, though. But it's
The Lemon Creek, are you going Heinzelman Ridge?
We're flying in by helicopter with Coastal. So Coastal's just doing a direct transport up there for us. And then we'll be basing out of the Lemon Glacier, just on the glacier camping and kind of doing more mountaineering type of skills, trekking and climbing for people who are interested. That's not, you know, mandatory, but really just doing more of a mountaineering type of experience for people who've never been up there with the safety of a guide. So, and again, what we really love about it is donating some of the proceeds to each different nonprofit we've chosen that kind of represents the area that we go. So it's exciting. We're excited to do it. And we hope our hope is just to be able to continue this every year and maybe offer different types of local expeditions so people who come out with us may want to try a new area for next year. Maybe we'll add on Berners Bay because we're permitted to go out there as well. So we have lots of different ideas for fun adventures.
What's the capacity of the groups that you guys are taking?
Yeah, so most of our group sizes are typically 10 maximum. So, and then it just depends on each trip, for example, because, you know, it depends, like, you can only fit so many people on a plane. So, you can only have, you know, each trip we might have four, and if it goes over four, we'd have to have another plane. So it just really, like, our group sizes usually are between 4 to 10 is what we can take out, and just depends on the trip and how many we get booked on each. So those are going throughout the summertime. And the
kayak over to Pack Creek, are you going to portage across from Oliver Inlet, across the Seymour Canal, and that whole thing on the little rail? That thing is so cool.
Yeah, so what we're actually going to do, so we have, we're going to have a water taxi. Our water taxi take us over to Oliver Inlet, drop us off right at the tram start.
Okay.
Then we'll portage across to Seymour Canal and then paddle to Pack Creek.
Nice.
And then that will give us some time to actually spend in the Pack Creek Sanctuary too for the day. So that will, just a nice, you know, again, it's just a 3-day trip. It gives you people an introduction who've never been to Pack Creek, an opportunity to go there. And again, it's just kind of fun to do a one-way route instead of a round trip too.
Yeah, and to spend time out there, it's not like a crazy amount of time, but it's really, you know, you feel like you've really been somewhere. You know, you transport out.
Yeah, no, it's really great. And you know, we also offer rentals out there in addition to our kayak shop in Auk Bay. So we now rent kayaks out at Windfall Island, so people could, fly out there on their own too if they want. Locals grab a kayak, rent it, and spend a couple days out there. And we always recommend more than one day. Because obviously, if you want to maximize your wilderness experience, you really want to be out in the wilderness as much as you can. So,
well, anything else people should know about what you guys are up to lately?
You know, the other thing we have coming up is, you know, we do our kayak classes, or beginner kayak classes and intermediate classes. Those take place at Auk Lake, and they're designed for people who, even if they're experienced paddlers, they teach people and refresh their skills on how to self-rescue and assist rescue. So, if you capsize and you're in the ocean, you're out with friends, how do you safely get someone back in their boat? And it goes over basic paddling strokes. And especially, it's nice if you do own a kayak, you can actually use your kayak for the class, so you can get comfortable on how it works if you were to capsize.
Now, I've done that on Auk Lake before. Is that where you guys
do it?
Yeah, I've done that class. It was so helpful.
Yeah.
And we tipped our kayak not like 3 weeks later. We were in a really weird situation up in Mitchell Bay.
Oh, Mitchell Bay has strange tides.
So that's what happened. Yeah. And we just, like, we kind of weren't doing anything necessarily totally wrong, although when I look back on it, it's like, well, we shouldn't have done that. But anyway, we tipped, and immediately it kicked in.
Yeah.
It was so helpful. it made us calm, and it made us like not panic. We knew what to do, and it's really worth doing. If you're out in a kayak at all, it's really worth taking that course.
And it's even if you know it, it's so nice to practice it, and you're actually in the water. Because what happens to our kayak classes, we outfit in dry suits and booties, so you do capsize, and you stay dry in the dry suits. And it gets you practicing getting back in your boat. So it's, we typically offer like one class a month, and those classes are posted on our kayak rental website. It's junokayak.com. But it is, our first class is in May. It's already almost full. I think we have one more space. We only take up to 10 people per class, but it's taught by American Canoe Association instructor. So it's either Brock Tabor, who's been teaching with us for a long time.
That's where I took it from, with Brock. Yeah, it was great.
And Brock's great. We have two other certified kayak instructors now, Corey and Dawn. So we do have, that way we are able to keep a mix of instructors and add more classes if need be. So lots of fun things. So lots of great opportunities for locals to get out and kayak and even be on the glacier with the Lemon Glacier Camp.
Great. And one more time, the web address where people can find
this stuff. So our guiding outfitter website is beyondak.com. And then for kayak classes, it's junokayak.com.
Great. Becky Janes, thanks so much for coming in.
It's wonderful
Appreciate it so much.
To see you, Andy.
Yeah, good to see you too.
Okay.
Blues you're hearing right there is none other than Curtis Salgado, and none other than that man himself is sitting right in front of me in the studio right now. Welcome, Curtis. Welcome to Juneau.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Have you been to Juneau before?
I have landed here. Can you hear me?
I can hear you just fine.
Really?
I'm sorry if those headphones, you can turn them up there a little bit. Really? Does that sound a little bit better now?
Hey.
There you
yes,
go.
Yes, well, that sounds good.
Okay.
I landed here to play in Haines.
Okay.
I think.
Yep.
And then we kind of flew off over the glaciers to land there and do. Oh, we had a great time.
Yeah.
Really nice people.
Well, I'm glad you're here on a day that's beautiful. You can sort of see the best of the city today. Often, it's low cover and
oh, really?
Hard to appreciate.
Well, today is a gorgeous day in Alaska.
Well,
here.
Curtis, you've had such a great and storied kind of career. So many accolades to what you do, but tell me a little bit about how blues was the thing that attracted you when you first started playing music, if that is in fact what first attracted you to the blues.
Well, first of all, and this isn't to be pretentious, is I like all music, and basically it's rhythm and blues. Blues, rhythm and blues, soul, funk, gospel, rock and roll. That's everything that's underneath the R&B umbrella, the rhythm and blues umbrella. You know, it's not just blues that we play.
Sure, okay. Yeah.
But just to keep things nice and edited,
what it was
is my folks were jazz enthusiasts, so I grew up on Count Basie and Jimmy Lunsford and Benny Goodman with with you know, Lionel Hampton and Gene Krupa, and Buck Clayton was this trumpet player that my dad really liked, and another guy named Henry Red Allen. And one of the top hit makers in our family were two guys. One of them was, this is kind of, Fats Waller, who was a great stride piano player, songwriter, entertainer, and Ray Charles, who was from Seattle, who spent a lot of time in Seattle, Washington. And my father had a brother, and his brother turned him on to Ray Charles.
So, oh, yeah.
So there was a lot of, you know, hip stuff playing in the household.
Yeah.
And I just took to it like a duck to water. You know, that was it.
And how did you decide on harp?
Well, it was guitar, but the guitar player that was teaching me was not a very good teacher. He was actually physically violent. And if you got something wrong, it hit you. So I didn't want to go back.
No.
After being bopped on the head for a month, I was like, I'm not going to do
this. That's the Catholic school model of learning guitar. Something. You get a whack on the wrist. I don't know what that is.
He learned from the nuns.
Yes.
So after that, you know, actually just the foresight of my mother was that she bought me a book called How to Play Blues Harmonica. And my sister brought in a record. And the record was Hate to See You Go by a cat named Little Walter. Yeah. Marion, yeah. Walter Jacobs was his name. Nicknamed Little Walter.
Chess Records.
Played with,
and
me,
all that,
played
yeah,
with
right.
Muddy Waters. Sail On was the other record, you know, so. But harmonica, so. My brother was into Paul Butterfield. He's older.
Yeah.
So all that stuff was coming up. And when my sister laid down Little Walter on me, that just is like,
that
wow.
That was okay.
This was it.
That was that kind
actually,
of a mind-blowing moment for you?
Yeah,
that was,
yeah. Paul yeah. Butterfield was mind-blowing, and then uh-huh. Little Walter took it to the next level.
Yeah, it's yeah. amazing. Did that make you, did you feel out of step with your contemporaries, or was there a kind of a rhythm and blues thing happening that you fell
well,
in
you
with?
You gotta understand,
or?
This is like, I'm 14, 15 years old. I'm still in junior high.
Mm-hmm.
There's no contemporaries. There's no... I know.
No,
this
well,
is
that's
what you,
yeah.
I don't,
you're just,
I don't
you're, just, in, you're yeah. just into what you're into at that
you're
point.
You're into
yeah,
what you're
right,
into
right.
exactly.
I guess I meant you know, to stay with the kind of R&B model, rhythm and blues model. It seems like maybe there was probably a little bit more push to go rock or something like that at that that time period. Or am
not,
I off?
No, it's just. Yeah. The radio at the time is AM radio.
So it's everything.
Everything's
yeah,
on there. The
right.
college kids are listening to underground music.
Right.
And the radio. So there's all this music, but I grew up listening to Count Basie.
Yeah, right.
And,
so that's...
and then I grew up listening to AM radio plus what my brother and sister were listening to, which was AM radio. But you got to understand, you know, back in the 1960s and stuff like that, the folk era came up. And along with that, they were rediscovering, white America was discovering black America in terms of music like Muddy Waters, John Lee Hooker, all the folk blues guys were still alive.
Mm-hmm.
Sunhouse was still alive.
Yeah.
You know, Mississippi Fred McDowell was still alive. You know, on and on and on.
Right.
All these people were playing the college campuses.
And of course, there was a huge movement there for a lot of the British acts, especially to be doing covering all
and
these great blues
and blues
artists.
And they had already been
seeing
them live.
Yeah.
Yeah,
right.
They were going over there since 1958.
Yeah. Right. But you were also instrumental in another interesting revival of blues and rhythm and blues in America, and that was Blues Brothers.
Yeah.
Yeah, so just a little bit about that. I mean, I don't know if it's a story you're tired of telling, but
no, of course
but
not.
You happened to meet John Belushi when he was working on Animal House. Is that how that went?
That's right, and that was done in Eugene, Oregon.
Right.
And that's where I was raised. And well, we had a popular band there, and we were hooking up with our partners in crime, a band called the Robert Cray Band. And both of the band that I was in, called the Nighthawks, and his band, I was living with Robert's bass player named Richard Cousins. And so we're all running around as this kind of contingency, you know, these two. So we would put on Blues Fest, our own little blues
right.
review.
I can imagine those are pretty smoking shows.
They were smoking. Man, and so, you know, Robert
there.
And I would open up the Robert or the Nighthawks would open up the show. The next band would be either the Nighthawks or Robert. And then the third set is when both bands got together and we played all these old soul tunes and funk tunes. And it was during this, one of these double-billed gigs at the Eugene Hotel that a guy came up to me and says, Blucci wants to meet you. And I had no idea who he was because I work on Saturdays.
Yeah.
And the other important part is that I didn't own a TV. I don't know what Saturday Night Live was.
Yeah,
I didn't know what he was, and I didn't care. And this guy kept annoying me, and then he introduced me to this guy, and I shook his hand, and I'm like, hey, hi. But I'm looking over at a group of girls over there, and a few of them I know, and I want to go in that direction, and I'm stuck with this guy. And it's like, hi, nice to meet you. Yeah, yeah, sure, like that. And the guy's looking at me, and basically it's a long story, but that's how we met.
Yeah.
The key thing that he said to me that really I spun my head around was like, oh, yeah, you're with the movie in here. He goes, yeah, I'm doing this movie here, and I fly back and forth from New York. I do this show called Saturday Night Live, and I just looked at him blank. I was blank, like, uh-huh, and?
Sure.
And he goes, well, I'm really excited about going there because we're going to do Ray Charles. I went, what? And he goes, yeah, you're gonna have Ray Charles on your show, and I still don't even know really what he's doing. And I said, you got to ask Ray Charles. I just went nuts on him. I said, Ray Charles, you got to ask him about Guitar Slim. He goes, who's Guitar Slim? I said, you don't know Guitar Slim? Well, blah blah blah, and I just went on and on,
uh-huh.
And that's kind of how we met.
Oh, that's
and
great.
And then
yeah.
He ended up calling me up, inviting me over to where he was staying. During the shooting of the movie, and we made close friends. And I met his. I'd go over there, and his wife would cook us dinner, and I'd bring him records, and yeah.
So
they dedicated the first record,
yeah,
Briefcase Full of Blues. Yeah.
And
a lot of the material on there, I handed him.
Right. Yeah. Amazing. And then Cab Calloway.
Character
named after you.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean,
that's
an amazing honor to have Cap Calloway.
Oh, I think so.
Take your name in a movie. That's pretty incredible.
I got to meet him too.
That's great.
Yeah.
Amazing. And it's an interesting thing, the whole Blues Brothers thing. I mean, I was when Briefcase Full of Blues came out, that was right in the pocket for me. I was of the age. I got that. That was my introduction to really the blues.
Well, it helps to have a great movie along with it. That
sure.
whole thing was the whole concept. Was,
right. Yeah.
And
all
that's
that.
Dan Aykroyd.
Yeah. That's right.
How that all went down and stuff is Dan Aykroyd was the one. He was already into the blues.
And he assembled this incredible band,
yeah.
You know, around that whole thing. And
well,
Briefcase Full of Blues and all that was incredible.
They assembled it. But Aykroyd was already into the blues, and John was not. And John told me this, and he goes, you know, Danny's been trying to get me into this music for a long time, and I just wasn't picking up on it. And Danny was championing a band called the Downchild Blues Band. And there was that band had brothers in it, these two guys that were brothers. So, Dan, you know,
mm-hmm.
Blues Brothers.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah. So, Downchild, you know, Blues Band is, you know, two of the members were brothers.
Fun, yeah.
So,
Well, you were making music, as you said, in the early 80s with the Robert Cray Band for a while. Then you kind of split off and formed your own group. You even were with Santana for a little bit, right?
Yeah, I did a summer
stint.
Tour with
him.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of been an interesting journey for you, right? I mean, the kind of all over the stratosphere of different kinds of music, of both blues, R&B, then even into Santana, which is,
yeah,
you know,
they're all not far from each other.
Yeah.
It's this, you know, music is, it's not far from each other. It's all underneath kind of the, you know.
Do you feel like
the same umbrella?
Do you feel like right now you have a sort of a focus or some things you're trying to bring to your music that maybe is a little bit different than years past?
No.
Okay. Does it have to do with the direction you're trying to take it in?
No, it's just what feels good.
Yeah.
You know, and I know my strengths and I know my weaknesses, and this is what I can do good.
Yeah.
And you know, for instance, I like George Jones. I like George Clinton.
Yes.
Right? I love big band jazz, and I love Beethoven, and I love music. That's what I like.
Right.
Can I do classical music? No, I can't. But what I do pretty much is hardcore rhythm and blues. I love Southern soul, deep South soul, and I love funk, a lot of funk. I'm a huge George Clinton fan, Bootsy, and everybody that's involved with that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And James Brown, of course, James Brown, Sly Stone, and Parliament, and Funkadelic, that's it right there. That's a whole category that influences me a lot.
Yeah.
And then, of course, jazz, you know. And I could name off a long list of that.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, you know, it's pretty much through the 60s. Up to then, I'm not... I like some fusion, some that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, I like the masters. John Coltrane and everybody in that large circle, you know.
Yeah.
So from early Jelly Roll Morton to John Coltrane.
Yeah, sounds good to me.
Yeah.
You were mentioning that your latest album is getting mixed right now, or just getting produced right now?
Yes, it is. It's being mixed right now as we talk.
So where did you record that, and what was the process there?
I live in Portland, Oregon. And then the rhythm section is on this new record I have coming out is half my band that you'll see tonight, and the other half are these LA studio musicians / friends of mine.
Yeah, cool.
Right. That.
Tell me a little bit about the process of going between you've recorded an album and then it goes and gets mixed. What are you kind of looking for out of that mix? Typically, are you looking for something real specific? Or are you looking for the mix?
This is a good question.
Yeah. Are you looking for it to pick up on whatever was happening in the studio at that moment? Or are you trying to refine it?
Well, you as a DJ,
or...
you know what mixing is.
Yeah.
So, you know, the guy that mixes it is compressing stuff, making it sound great. You can put it in the right speaker. You can put it in the left. You can put it so it sounds like it's coming straight dead center. You can, you know, you can make things, basically you can take somebody who sounds like crap and make them sound great,
mm-hmm.
you know, basically, which is happening a lot these days.
Yeah.
You know, you could do anything you want in a studio, but for me, it's all organic.
Uh-huh.
So the band plays live. My band's in the studio, we lay down a track, and then you put sweetening on top of it.
But
and
really, the main track is this one take.
It's all main track.
Yeah,
but
okay.
You want the rhythm section to be live and in the pocket.
Sure, yeah.
Not, you know, starting with this and then whatever. And then you throw the horn section on it, and you throw the background and the lead vocals. But it's playing, and all of that is live. If I record a horn section, there's five guys standing in a studio playing to the track of a live band that I had recorded a week or so ago in Los Angeles.
Right. So does the room you record in make a big difference,
yes,
you think?
Everything makes a difference.
Yeah.
Everything.
What are you looking for when you have a room that you think is good?
Depends on what you want.
Yeah.
You know, I'll tell you something. Somebody who engineers, here's a good example. Have you ever heard of Amy Winehouse?
Yeah.
That record, Back to Black record, sounds like an old Motown record, kind of.
Mm-hmm.
But it's got this retro kind of, you know, modern contemporary sound.
Yeah.
It's got this other vibe to it.
Yeah, Mark Ronson was producing that and did really amazing stuff with that.
Right,
didn't
he do David Bowie? But the people that he hired to play on it were the Daptones.
Who
are specialized in sounding like old school Motown.
Yeah, right.
So, you know, then he mixed it and whatever. I mean, that album just, so it's all like that.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It's the engineer really is the... is the unsung hero of, I mean, look, here's a great example. You got the Beatles, and they're sitting in a studio, but who makes them sound like?
Yeah,
I mean,
George
the
Martin,
sound
man.
Of those records are fantastic.
Yeah.
You can't beat that. I mean, the early stuff.
And when they went to Phil Spector or other guys, you realize, oh, George Martin, now I get what he was doing.
Exactly.
Yeah, right, yeah.
So, you know, there's all these great engineers out there that, so that's it. He can make you or break you.
Well, Curtis, thanks so much for coming in and talking to us for a little bit. We're going to hear one more track. You're playing tonight.
Yes, sir.
It's exciting. Part of the Juno Jazz and Classics. We're so glad to have you in town.
Thank you. You going to be there?
I'm going to be there.
Okay,
absolutely.
Good. I got a great band. These guys are deadly. So.
All right.
Yeah.
Deadly.
These guys are good.
All right.
So,
Cover your eyes, man. Right. You be watching. You walk in.
You'll be tapping.
Don't look
feet.
Directly at them.
Yeah, we're bright.
It's dangerous.
Deadly.
It's like
these
opening
guys
the
are
arc.
Great musicians. You don't want to do this at home.
All right.
There's no nets. No, nothing.
Curtis Delgado, thanks so much for coming in playing tonight.
Thanks for having me.
And here's another track. This is a little bit more of what you might be hearing tonight if you go see him. Thanks again, man.
Mm-hmm.
Be playing the Blues Cruise. That's sold out at 5 p.m., but there's still some room on the 9 p.m. Saturday Blues Cruise. Curtis Saldago. So amazing to talk to him and talk to him about music and listen to his music. And coming up next, Lainey Welch is here with us. Lainey, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, I'm thrilled to be here.
And Lainey, of course, everyone knows you so well for doing the Fish Radio out of Kodiak for so many years. And you're also the author of the Fish Factor column that's in Capital City Weekly. So
right.
Great
plus
to follow
about,
you.
Yeah, about 20 other papers as well and in the UK.
Yeah, well, are you in the UK as well now?
Yeah.
Teaching those Brits a thing or two about fish management.
That's right.
So what's going on in fisheries? All right. But Lainey, you're here in town because you're going to be part of the Maritime Festival, the Juno Maritime Festival. Tell me a little bit about what you're expecting there. You're part of the kind of the dinner that's happening, right?
Well, there's a dinner this evening, a fundraising dinner. I was brought here courtesy of the Juno Economic Development Council. And boy, I'm telling you, I'd like to bottle some of their energy and enthusiasm and bring it back to Kodiak in terms of the way they just seem to seek out and new opportunities for the community in Southeast. But anyway, so they brought me here. I'll be making a presentation tonight at the special dinner. And then tomorrow at the Maritime Festival, I'll sort of be doing the play-by-play, I guess you want to call it, with all the different events that are going on there.
Oh, okay. You get to MC it.
Yeah. I'll be calling the shots for the people that are racing in totes. And
That's funny. Have you seen that yet?
No,
oh,
I haven't.
Oh, that's amazing.
I might have to bring that back to Kodiak
for some of our celebrations. Thank goodness the Coast Guard is on hand during these, I'll tell you.
And speaking of which, the Coast, yeah, and actually, how timely they will, the Coast Guard is doing a search and rescue, not a search, but a rescue mission right in the channel. So who knows, maybe the rescue will be one of these these people in these silly fish toasts. I don't know.
It sounds like a lot of fun. And I think the weather is supposed to hold, so we'll hope for that.
Filet contest, too. I'll be, doing the play-by-play for that. There's just a really good lineup of events. I'm looking forward to seeing the canoe arrivals, one people
yes.
canoe, I think it's called, and the opening ceremony, that's at 11. And there's a sailing race. Brian Holst at JEDC said there's 8 or 9 sailboats that have signed up for a sailing race.
There is. It's a buoy-to-buoy race happening out in the channel. I actually got to crew on one of the boats that's going to racing in that last weekend. And that's right. Those guys are all really excited about that. And, they want a good win.
Yeah, that's at 9:30. I guess 9:30, that's going to be sort of a pre-festival little tantalizer.
Yeah. It's so great to, have Juno focus a little bit on and have a festival and celebration of the impact that all the maritime jobs and all the activities that happen out of Juno and out of Southeast Alaska and focus the festival on it. Yeah.
You bet. I mean, because, it's just not the amount of fishing boats, of which there are 703 fishing vessels home ported here.
Wow, 703. Yes. That's amazing. I would never have guessed that many.
Yeah. 703 vessels home ported. That's very well documented. And the 800 resident fishermen, 526 processing jobs. But not only with the fishing component, but you have, the tugs, the barges, the cruise ships, the Coast Guard. It's just such a maritime community.
Yeah.
That's the celebration. And I think it's really exciting that Juno often is so overshadowed by it being the capital city and, all the goings on with the legislature. And, it's just really nice to draw attention to the fact that it's the reason all these people are here is because of the maritime focuses.
I agree. Lenny, what else is going on with you? What other stuff are you working on?
Oh boy!
That's a big question, I know, but
yeah, anything to do with fisheries, of course, to the boredom of everyone who knows me. but I'm just always looking for ways to promote this industry. I just, it's the number one private employer in our state. It puts more people to work than oil and gas, mining, timber, and tourism combined. I've been saying that for 25 years, and I won't stop saying it. And,
good reminder, though. Yeah,
it is. And then, and also, when spending a couple of days here in Juneau, and just realizing that, my gosh, you have because of fishing, you have United Fishermen of Alaska, the largest commercial fishing trade group in the nation, and actually, where I got all those numbers about 703. Fishing vessel home ported and 800 fishermen is from United Fishermen of Alaska's fishing fact sheets that they put out every year. They break down how the fishing industry circulates through every single fishing community in Alaska and the state. So anyway, anyone can get their hands on those. But there's, so we have UFA, Alaska Seafood Marketing Institute, the U.S. Coast Guard. I just literally got back from touring Auk Bay Lab, and the work that is going on there is just, from seaweed to Bering Sea surveys, it just is mind-boggling. And all of these entities are here because of the seafood industry.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, it's a great reminder, the Juneau Maritime Fest. It's coming up tomorrow, starts in the morning. I guess it's kind of the pre-race happens out in the channel. You could watch it at 9:30, and then the Maritime Fest cranks up a little bit later. I think starts at 10, is that right?
No, 11 to 5.
11, okay.
11 to 5. I guess there's going to be live music all day,
yeah.
And, you know, just all kinds of events planned and vendors and food and, yeah, just a real full day of events. And I'm just so thrilled to be a part of it. I've only been to Juneau. Well, I was here years ago in the winter.
Well, Lainey, thanks so much. We got to run.
That's
but
all right.
Thanks so much. Great talking to you. That's Lainey Welch. She's going to be at the Juneau Maritime Festival. And you can go see her and say hello to her there. Thanks, Lainey.
You bet.
Thank you.
Bye.
And now here's All Things Considered.
The parties on this issue.
The politics of immigration policy.
Today is Friday, May 8th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. Also in this hour, politics with Friday regulars David Brooks and E.J. Dionne.
In Liberia, there's a measles outbreak. It's seen as a consequence of vaccinations that weren't given when the country was in an all-out battle with Ebola.
To have this number in just the first quarter of this year is definitely a huge outbreak.
A milestone in the air. The concentration of greenhouse gas hits a record high.
We have to go back approximately 3 to 4 million years to have CO2 levels that high.
And farewell to Sweetbriar College.
Now the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Speer. The U.S. military is increasing the threat level at American military bases. Officials say there is no specific threat against any base, but increased